This is, of course, the session on severe weather and climate. Is juiced up severe weather the new normal? So if you were, if that's not what you were here for, stick around anyway. And I want to thank Mohit, Pam, and Tom for driving here. Mohit came up last night, and Pam and Tom, it's a three-hour drive from where they came this morning, so we really appreciate it. So we did lose a speaker because of the shutdown. We lost Tom Carl from, he's the head of the NCDC, which National Climatic Data Center, I got that right. And so we've got a little bit more time, and I thought what we'd do is something a little different just for the benefit of our speakers. In terms of who's in the audience, I'd like to go around the room, and if you could quickly give your name and your affiliation. Okay. Thank you very much. So we're going to start. So anyway, we're going to look at climate and how it interacts with weather, and Mohit is our first speaker. We'll go down the panel. I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll open it up right away. So Mohit's expertise is in computational climate science and atmospheric physics. And one of the things we learned at Oak Ridge during our tour is that your science in the future is going to be about as good as your modeling and your computational capacity. So this is an area of expertise that's really proving to be important as we move forward and understand our world. He, in addition to specializing in modeling, he also looks specifically at water and regional impacts. And so what Mohit is going to help us understand is what the immediate decades ahead are going to look like because of the locked-in effect of current carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It has a delayed reaction on our weather. And so we'll start with that. Mohit, if you could tell us a little bit about the regions of the country that you've studied and how their climate is going to change in a kind of a locked-in fashion and what we know so far.
Thank you very much. So my name is Mohit Ashfaq. I'm a computational climate scientist at Oak Ridge National Lab. So my research mostly focuses on the regional processes and how they are going to respond to the increasing greenhouse gas forcings, especially in next few decades. So as a part of my research, I have focused on two main areas over the continental U.S. One is western U.S. snow cover, another is the frequency and intensity of the heat waves across the country. Now, the western U.S. Like a hot spot for the snow cover because if you look at the last 50 years of records, you see that there's a sharp decline in the snow accumulation in the wintertime, which means that we are seeing less and less snow accumulation during, say, December, January, February, and March in the western U.S. And that's very critical because, like, California gets, like, 60% of the water in the summer and springtime from this snowmelt. So if you have less snow happening in the wintertime or less snow accumulation in the wintertime, that's going to drastically affect the water resources in the spring and summertime in the California. Now, what we looked at doing high-resolution regional climate modeling is how snow cover is going to respond to near-term changes in temperature and precipitation. So we looked at until 2040. We expect that temperature may rise up to 1 to 2 degrees over parts of the western U.S. So we ran our high-resolution climate modeling system, which runs at 12-kilometer horizontal grid spacing, which means that we divide the country in 12-kilometer grid boxes. And then we saw the physical processes that govern the snow hydrology in the western U.S. So what we found that the kind of acceleration of the decline in snow accumulation that we are seeing right now, that's going to further accelerate, which means that you'll see more and more years with less and less snow in the wintertime. And secondly, what we found that snow melt will occur earlier in the season. Now, both of these things, what we found, and I think which was the most important finding, is driven by temperature. Now, why it's important? Because we have more faith on our temperature projection than precipitation projection. So if we say that western U.S. snow change in the next few decades is driven by precipitation, we may say that it's very uncertain because precipitation projections are very uncertain over most regional climate projections in the IPCC assessments. But all of us know that temperature would rise. So if something is driven by temperature, we have a good faith that it may actually happen if the temperature projections actually hold for the next three decades. So what does that really mean? That it comes in two kinds of changes. One, that because of rise in temperature, you may see less days in the wintertime over the western U.S. when snow actually can happen. You know, the precipitation falls as solid and liquid. For the solid precipitation to happen, you have to have low temperatures. So if temperature is rising, you may have that precipitation happening as a liquid form rather than a solid form. And secondly, if, say, you have snow happening still at the same rate, but you have higher temperature on the ground, that's going to melt much faster. So what does that mean? That collectively, that you end up with less snow in the spring and summertime. And also, because of the snow melt occurring earlier because of the higher temperatures, you're going to have a hydrological shift in timing, which means the crops that need, say, water in the spring and summertime, that may not have that kind of water which is available right now. So this is one of the things that we are seeing in the western U.S. Secondly, we look at the heat waves across the U.S., again, using the high-resolution modeling system. And what we found that heat waves are going to intensify in next 3 to 4 decades. Now, that's not something that we only see in our high-resolution modeling system. All the IPCC projections in AR4 and, again, in AR5 show similar results. Only a new thing that we are seeing is that actually the frequency intensity that we are seeing in our high-resolution modeling system is much higher than what we see in the coarse-resolution GCMs. And one of the particular regions that is going to be critically affected by this increase in heat waves in western, southwestern U.S. Now, southwestern U.S. is one of the hot spots already identified in terms of climate. Why is southwestern U.S.? If you go in the technical details, it's because the variability of temperature is not very high in the western U.S. In the historical period. So if something is not variable, it takes very little change to move it to a new climate state. So which means that if you want a region where you expect the emergence of a new climate state would be the region where you have very less variability in the historical time. So western U.S. is one of those regions. If you compare that with, say, southeastern U.S., this is one of the regions where you may not see emergence of a new climate state where things are totally different from what you see right now, may not come until end of the 21st century. Why? Because of the same reason that there is a very high variability of temperature and precipitation over this region. But remember that because southeastern U.S. is one of the regions where you see most of the precipitation extremes, and there are very robust projections that these extremes are actually going to increase in the future. So the region where you see higher temperatures prevailing in the summertime these days, these are the regions where you actually would see more heat waves, more robust heat waves in the future, which is southwestern U.S. And the region where you see normally the extreme weathers like southeastern U.S., is the region which will be more affected by the precipitation extremes in the near-term decades. So I think I'll close with this. Okay. Thank you.
Just a couple of quick questions. When you said the 1 to 2 degrees by 2040, was that Fahrenheit or Celsius?
It's centigrade.
Okay, so it would be about double, right, for Fahrenheit?
Well, again, remember that when I say 1 to 2 degrees, it's the worst higher-end scenario. I'm not talking about the lower-end scenarios. If you look at IPCC projections, they are lower-end to higher-end scenarios. So the new IPCC projections say that an RCP 8.5, which is higher-end scenario, that actually goes up to, say, 3.7 degrees centigrade by the end of the 21st century. But that's like a global mean temperature. When we look at the regions, some of the regions may see, say, up to 5 to 7 degrees change. So we are not talking about the global mean. We are talking about the regional temperatures that may have a very large variation than what we see in the global means.
Okay. And, yeah. And again, this is just in the next 30 years or so that you were talking.
Yeah, that's correct.
When you say the heat waves are going to be more robust in the southwest, what would that look like? Do you have a sense of what that would look like for the communities?
Well, I mean, you know that heat waves has a direct impact on human health. Now, if you have longer days with the longer heat waves, which are more intense and which are more frequent, you expect to have more and more health issues. Also, your energy demand is going to go high because then you need more refrigeration, more use of energy to cool down temperatures within your homes. So definitely it's going to have an effect on energy consumption. It's going to have an effect on human health. And also it's going to have effect on other human and natural systems. I'm not an expert in that, but, well, if something changes from its norm, you definitely see effects across the board. So so you expect to see all of the worst effect things that may happen when you see heat waves.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. And that's a perfect segue to go to Pam. And the way we're going to do this is we'll work through the panel here, and then we'll have questions from the audience at the end. And so Pam has a lot of expertise in how climate and weather affects daily life through her years as state climatologist. And she is an agricultural climatologist, which puts her really in tune with kind of the natural rhythm of the world. And she works at the Department of Climate, because I didn't say Oak Ridge for you, so I apologize. but she's with the University of Georgia, and she is the former state climatologist up in Wisconsin, so she has a sense of two different parts of the country, too. So, Pam, can you talk to us a little bit about some of the ways we're already seeing weather affect the farm field and the backyard?
Sure. As far as weather affecting the farm fields, you have to keep in mind that I'm now in the Southeast, even though I sound like I'm from Wisconsin. And in the Southeast is in kind of a climate hole. We haven't really seen a lot of the changes in temperature that we've seen in other parts of the country, which makes it a little confusing for people who live there. And they say, well, we really haven't seen the climate change that much. If you tease out the details, it turns out that yes, actually, temperature has been going up since about 1960, but it's a little bit more subtle than in some other parts of the country where you can see changes in things like the amount of time that ice is over lakes and things like that. We have seen some changes in the length of the growing season, and so you can plant different varieties of crops now that take a little bit longer to mature. Combined with that, of course, you also have increases in the number of pests because the pests now also have a longer time to grow. And so you can see things if you're into mosquitoes, and mosquitoes certainly would have increased over time. Obviously, that depends in large part also on rainfall, and rainfall variability has been one thing that's changed a lot over time. We've seen changes in not only the pests, but also in different kinds of diseases, because many diseases of plants and animals are also tied to the climate. And so as you increase your length of your growing season, you increase the temperatures, you start to see some of the effects from that as well. And so that is one of the changes we've seen. We've also seen changes in precipitation in terms of the variability. I think it's true that across the whole country, we've seen a change in precipitation to more extreme or thunderstorm kind of rainfall, where you have very high-intensity rainfall and then longer dry spells in between. That has some interesting management characteristics because you really have to worry a lot more about things like erosion. If you're putting out manure piles and you worry about rain falling on those manure piles and washing that off into streams, then if you're getting the higher intensity rain, that's going to cause a problem with your management strategy, and you have to really figure out how to deal with that. Also, if you're depending on drawing water in a drought from a stream, if pumping in Georgia is legal to pump out of a stream, and there's some legal considerations there. But if you're counting on the stream to be there and you're going to what you might consider a more flashy system where you have higher extreme rainfalls but longer dry spells in between, you're probably going to see lower stream flow overall. That's going to have impacts on both how you use that stream for agriculture, but also, obviously, on the ecology of that stream. And so that's another thing that we've seen over time. One thing we have not really seen, and that's probably partly because of the nature of frost, is we have not seen any big trends in the nature of when the last frost or when the first frost occurs. Frosts are really tied to weather almost more than they are to climate. They're tied to individual weather events or outbreaks. And so we haven't been able to really put the same kind of trend analysis on on the dates of the first and last frost that we have on average temperatures. We do know that average temperatures are going up. It's a little hard to relate that to exactly the length of the growing season. I've got some research going on with that now. Because, you know, when you talk to a farmer and you say, well, we're expecting to see a temperature going up 1 or 2 degrees in the next 10 or 20 years, they say, well, what does that mean? Because that doesn't really relate to any kind of management decision that I have to make. They're worried about how many days until I can harvest a crop. And you need to know something about what the growing degree days is for that particular crop. You need to know what the variety is, the maturity date, and so on. And average temperature doesn't really capture that very well. And so that's one of the areas where climatology really needs to work to take the numbers we get from some of the big climate models and to transfer them into information that's in a useful form for the farmers. So that's one of the things that we're working on. We do know precipitation has changed. The annual average trend in precipitation across the southeast is pretty constant. But it's really changed both in terms of how intense it is and also by season. In the southeast, we know that the wettest season, or the season that's becoming wetter over time, is the fall, which has some really critical issues for things like harvesting. Because it's got to be dry enough so that the grain can dry out or the peanuts can dry out before they get those into the harvest bins. And if you go to a wetter fall season, that's going to affect your ability to harvest. I know this weekend people are scrambling like mad to get the peanuts in because we've got Tropical Storm Karen out in the Gulf, and they're worried about having those peanuts out in the fields getting re-wet by the tropical storm, and that is likely to lead to an increase in things like aflatoxin. And so the way you manage, and that's related obviously to both weather and climate, you have to deal with both when you're a farmer, and keep that in mind. But we know also that because of these extremes in the rainfall, we're going to a period where it looks like we're having more droughts over time, at least 4 months when we're in drought. That probably is related as much to the increase in temperature as it does to the changes in precipitation, because temperature, as it goes up, is going to lead to higher evaporation rates. So even if the rainfall stays the same, we're likely to see more evaporation and more drying of the area as a whole. And we have seen, in Georgia at least, some increase in the number of months with drought. Now, you got to keep in mind, you know, the last 15 years, we've had 3 different droughts in Georgia. And some of those have been widely covered by the media, especially the one that hit Atlanta, where the governor was praying for rain, and they were worried about Atlanta running out of water in 6 weeks, which probably wasn't going to happen. The drought we had since then was mostly in South Georgia, where there's not a big media presence, and it was very quiet. Not very many people talked about it, even though there are certain parts of the state that were worse off than Atlanta was. But there's differences in the way things are covered over time. Droughts are also tricky because it obviously depends on growing season. If you're up in the north in Wisconsin, if you have a drought in the middle of winter, you're probably not overly concerned because you don't have a lot of things growing anyway. And so that may not really manifest itself until you get to spring and you start to have the plants coming out of their dormancy, or you're planting things and trying to get them to grow, and all of a sudden you realize that the soil is really dry and that you have to deal with that. And so winter droughts and summer droughts don't necessarily look exactly the same. And so that's something that we have to think about over time.
Thank you. And can you talk a little bit about, well, just to tease out one point that you made about the disconnect between the last freeze date, first freeze date, and the overall climate trend. Can you explain why that matters to the farmer in terms of the state that the crop might be in, and the backyard gardener too? Does that make sense?
Frost is important. Some of the farmers have told me that climate you can kind of make up for by the way you manage your crops, but weather events can just knock it off completely once. If you have a hailstorm, for example, that comes and hits your apple crop and marks up the apples, you've really destroyed their value, and you might be able to sell them for juice, but you're probably not going to be able to sell them because they've got cosmetic blemishes. Or it might wipe out a crop completely. The same thing is true with the frost. If you remember back to spring of 2012, my parents live up in Michigan, and there it was warm really early. A lot of the fruit trees bloomed early, and then there was a late, or maybe not so late for them, but it was later than they expected frost, and it wiped out nearly all of their crops. And that's a real issue where weather is almost as important as climate. Now you can certainly talk about the relationship between weather events and weather extremes and climate, because climate describes not only averages but also the extremes. But certainly that's something that has an impact. Again, if you have a fall frost that's fairly early, it can stop the plants from growing by killing off the leaves. And so they might not develop to their fullest potential. You might have reduced yields, and those yields translate into dollars for the farmers. If you have less yields, then you're putting on less weight on the grains, or you're having a smaller size on your fruit or something like that. And so that certainly has an effect as well.
Yeah, and so that's relevant in town also when we write about our gardens and our fruit trees and our backyards are vulnerable then to a late spring freeze. They'll come out early with their blossoms because it's been warm, that climatic trend. So that disconnect is something that I know that I'm already writing about in my stories. And then could you talk, please, a little bit about warm nights as a climate trend and how that affects pollination, how that might affect my tomatoes, my zucchini, and then the corn crop in general, and why that's such a delicate crop.
Yeah. A lot of the early climate models only gave a change in the average temperature over time. The more recent ones, including the ones that our other speakers have talked about, really are able now to tease out a little bit more about separate trends in daytime temperature from trends in nighttime temperature. And it turns out that they have different effects. If we look at the impacts of high daytime temperatures, certainly in the worst cases, it can affect things like animal health. Certainly will also affect things like the ability of corn, for example, to pollinate or grow. Corn really, after about 86 degrees Fahrenheit, stops growing, or at least the rate of growing is greatly reduced. And so if you go towards more days with really high temperatures, that affects your corn yield because the corn just really shuts down and is not filling those kernels as it's going on. It turns out that nighttime temperatures are really important for things like animal health. Animals, just like humans, really respond almost more to nighttime temperatures and the lack of cooling than daytime temperatures. Because as long as you have animals going through a period of coolness at night, it gives them enough relief so that they can go through and recover and maintain their health. But after about two or three nights where the temperature stays relatively warm, and it depends on the particular species of animal, what that exact temperature is, then there's no way for them to recover, and then you really start to see declines in, for example, the amount of meat that they put on or the amount of milk that they produce. And so that nighttime temperature turns out to be really critical for animal health and human health as well. If you go into some of the history of some of the heat waves in the Midwest and other places where air conditioning is not as predominant as it is in the South, really the third day turns out to be really critical for human health and seeing an increase in mortality because the humans, just like any other animal, are not really able to handle that prolonged period of heat stress without having some kind of relief. And that's why so much effort has gone into developing things like cooling centers, trying to find ways to get people out of the heat for a period of time so they can recover. That's certainly been true as well. So nighttime temperatures and daytime temperatures and the trends in both of those are important, but not necessarily for the same reason.
And we saw that in Nebraska quite a bit. During the summer when it was so hot during the day, the farmers had the water, but the corn just couldn't deal with the heat. And then you'll see this in your own backyard garden when it's got successive warm nights. You can talk to your local county extension agent, and they'll give you the temperature cutoff, but I think it's 80, something above 80, where your tomatoes aren't going to pollinate. You know, your zucchini's not going to pollinate. So you'll have your callers saying, well, my plant looks great. It's lush. It's growing, but I'm not getting any tomatoes. What am I doing wrong? It's not that they're doing anything wrong. It's just that it's too hot at night. It's too warm at night, which was a lesson we seem to relearn every year in Nebraska. And then we've got Tom. So Tom Moat is also from the University of Georgia. He's the head of the Department of Geography, and he's a professor there. And then he's the founding director of Georgia's Atmospheric Sciences Program. Tom specializes in studying snow cover and ice cover across North America, and he uses satellite imagery to do that. And I was hoping that Tom could explain to us a little bit about why that's so important, the idea of snow cover across the north and ice, and how that affects our weather down here.
Okay. Well, this has been a topic that's been very much in the news recently about how changes in the Arctic and how changes in snow cover may be affecting our climate in the mid-latitudes, particularly sort of the persistence of individual weather patterns. So I'll move up a little bit closer here. So Mohit spoke earlier about snow cover as a water resource. So we know in the West that snow cover in the mountainous regions is probably about the most important water resource that they have available. I'm also interested in snow cover as a component of the climate system. If you think about the Earth's surface, and we can have a wet surface, we can have dry soil, we can have plants green up in the spring. These are all changing the land cover, land surface, and it's affecting the climate. But probably the most profound change that we have in the land surface is to place snow cover over it. We dramatically increase the reflectivity and we cool the overlying atmosphere. Or if we replace open ocean in the Arctic with sea ice, it essentially decouples the ocean from the atmosphere. You no longer have evaporation of water going into the atmosphere. And you also have this very reflective surface replacing a very dark surface. So we know that we can force the climate system, we can change the climate system very dramatically by the amount of snow cover, the amount of sea ice that we have. In recent years, we've seen numerous stories about the very dramatic changes we've seen in the Arctic. Last year, we had the record minimum in sea ice cover. There was the discussion of the so-called recovery this year, where we did see an increase in sea ice, but still much below what we've seen during the past 30 years. We saw the dramatic changes in Greenland last summer, where we saw melt at the very highest elevations of the Greenland ice sheet for the first time, we think, since 1889, and probably only the second time in the last 700 or 800 years. So very dramatic changes in the Arctic. And some of the questions have been how that's influenced our climate in the mid-latitudes. So there's been some very prominent work by Jennifer Francis, for instance, at Rutgers University that's been widely publicized, talking about how we think that there's evidence that changes in the Arctic are actually influencing the jet stream, and we're locking into patterns in the mid-latitudes of either very heavy precipitation or perhaps drought and heat waves as a result of these changes in the Arctic. And the logic behind this is really fairly straightforward. One of the first things I talked to my students about in our introductory level weather and climate class is what the atmosphere is trying to do when we have circulation of the atmosphere. We have wind, we have the jet stream. It's trying to equalize this temperature imbalance between the equatorial regions and the polar regions. So we have extra energy in the equatorial regions. We have lots of sun. It's very warm. In the polar regions, we have a deficit of energy, and the atmosphere is trying to redistribute that energy through one of the ways that we do this is through the jet stream. And so if that temperature imbalance is not as great, if we have a warmer Arctic, then we potentially have changes in the wind speed and the amplitude and how rapidly the jet stream is moving. And if the jet stream tends to be locked into place more frequently, you know, tends to be locked into place, that may lock into our weather patterns as well. And so that's still very much a topic that's open for research and debate and conversation. There was just actually a big meeting at the National Academy of Sciences, a workshop where they were looking at this question of what is the role of Arctic amplification, this warming in the Arctic on the jet stream. There's a World Climate Research Program is having a meeting next month in Iceland actually looking at this very issue as well.
Okay. And just to tease out a little bit that idea of changes in the jet stream. So as I understand it, the jet stream drives its speed, and this is my layman's understanding, from that difference in temperature. It's cold up at the Arctic, it's warm at the poles, and so that makes for a faster jet stream that just heads from west to east, and in an oversimplified way. And as the Arctic warms, the jet stream becomes lazier, there's less speed. Can you talk about how that looks when you say it looks loopy, right? And how it goes from being a fast river to being kind of loopy, lazy river. How does that affect weather patterns? What's the difference between a west-east flow for weather and a more loopy jet stream, and how that affects weather patterns?
Well, we think about variability in weather. So we may have areas of of low pressure cyclones that are moving through, and those areas of low pressure cyclones that may have, you'll see on the weather map, where they have warm fronts and cold fronts associated with them. They'll have areas of precipitation. And so as these areas of low pressure, these cyclonic systems move through, your weather will change. You'll go through a period where you may have a warm, sunny period. You'll see an area of precipitation. You may see colder weather that follows. These cyclones tend to follow along the jet stream. So if you have a jet stream that is moving very rapidly from west to east, you'll see a lot of these systems move through. You'll see your weather change. We also know that if you look at the jet stream under areas where you have a dip in the jet stream, those are associated with areas of cooler weather, and areas where we have large bulges or ridges in the jet stream are associated with areas of warmer than normal weather usually. So if we see these patterns tend to lock into place, you're going to see fewer of these cyclonic systems pass by, potentially. And you'll also, if you tend to be locked in underneath a ridge, you'll tend to be locked in under an area where you have warmer than normal conditions, drier than normal conditions. If you're locked in underneath a trough, you might be locked in areas where you have colder than normal weather. Mm-hmm. And if the jet stream tends to be locked into place, you're going to stay in that same weather pattern for, you know, periods of days to weeks. So if you look at, just look at a map of the jet stream, you can get a very good idea of what weather is going to look like in any given location just from that one map.
And so it helps me when I think of a trough or a downward loop. That allows that Arctic air to come south, right? And then the ridge, the upward part, allows south air to flow up. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that warmth and coldness is coming from. And you also have probably heard this in terms of blocking patterns that have affected big weather events here. Can you talk about a couple of blocking patterns that have affected our weather?
Blocking patterns are essentially just patterns in the jet stream where the jet stream tends to be locked into place and not moving. Mm-hmm. So exactly the sort of thing that we're talking about here. So one classic example recently where we saw a blocking pattern that played a very important role in the weather was with Hurricane Sandy. So as Hurricane Sandy was moving up the East Coast, there was a blocking pattern, very intense blocking pattern that was locked in over the North Atlantic. As Sandy, normally these systems we say recurve. So as they're moving northward, they'll tend to start to move westward again and out over the ocean. I'm sorry, eastward, I should say, and out over the ocean. But in this case, that blocking pattern actually redirected Sandy almost at a 90-degree angle into the east coast of the United States and resultant damage that we saw along the east coast. And so that blocking pattern, while itself didn't result in any of the damage of the storm, but it directed the storm in such a way that it had really maximum impact on the east coast of the United States. So that's a very good example. We think about the drought that we've seen over the interior of North America over the last couple of years. Again, we were in a pattern where we were locked in with a ridge that was located over the central part of the United States. It's very difficult to develop these afternoon thunderstorms that we'll typically see in the summertime, mm-hmm. when you're underneath one of these big bulges or ridges in the mm-hmm. jet stream. Mm-hmm. And so that's another example of how these types of patterns will influence our weather.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Ready for questions?
Yes.
Can you state yourself, your name, please, again, for the record, for the audience, for the audio?
Kathy Kowalski, freelance journalist. What sorts of patterns do you anticipate will become more common for the Midwest?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think, one of the things, we have these patterns that develop in the atmosphere that are very common. So we talk about patterns like the North Atlantic pattern, North Atlantic oscillation, or the Pacific North American teleconnection. These are patterns in pressure or patterns in the jet stream that we've identified through looking at historical observations. One of the things we know is that climate models do struggle to adequately represent those patterns. And so it's difficult to really say with any kind of fidelity what kind of patterns we might see that will lock in or won't over any given region with the climate models we have now. I mean, and perhaps you might be able to speak to that as well. But I think that's something that the models have struggled to do, is to reproduce those low frequency modes of variability in the atmosphere.
So Tom is correct. We should understand that these climate models that are used, say, in a latest IPCC assessment report, their typical resolution, which is like grid spacing, is like 200 kilometers or, say, 150 kilometers. That means that they are unable to resolve anything that is smaller than that scale. Now, for example, if you want to understand how tornadoes are going to be frequent or intense or what, well, you cannot get that answer directly from these kind of climate models because tornadoes, their scale is like few kilometers or even less than a kilometer sometime. So these things are not resolved in these climate models. Now, but these climate models can still tell you that the bigger environment that actually leads to these tornado kind of activity, whether that's going to intensify or not. So there's a recent research, the paper that came out in PNAS, that actually tells that, yes, the climate, the environment that actually leads to this stronger tornadic activity, that's going to get more frequent and more intense in future. But that does not necessarily mean that how frequent tornadoes would be or where they would happen more frequently over the which part of the U.S., that's not certain, again, because these models do not tell you very specifically because of their coarseness in resolution that where these things might happen. But overall, the bigger picture, they tell, yes, the environment will be more intense and more favorable for these kind of storms. Remember that these kind of extremes require moist and warm air flowing from Gulf. That would be more probable for the future time when you have more moisture in the atmosphere. And then but they also require like the cold air coming from the Arctic to have a very strong shear. So, again, as Tom said, is you cannot say for sure that how these things are going to evolve in future. But in generally speaking, yes, there will be more favorable conditions environmentally to create these kind of extreme events.
Let me just add something real quick, only because I live in the Midwest and have to write about it. One theory is that we're going to have more extreme weather because the southeast, southwest will become hotter and drier, and the northeast will become wetter. That being in the middle of a continent sets you up for extremely volatile weather because you have the clashing forces in the north, cold, south, warm, moist, dry, to the and so those differences will be more intense, and the resulting weather will be more extreme and more variability. So you'll have a more confusing weather system that you have to live within.
If I might add to that, because we're actually looking at in my lab at some of the very issues that Mohit was just talking about, in terms of trying to simulate what types of environments that we will see in the future for producing severe weather. So these climate models and even the very high resolution regional climate models that are run cannot resolve individual tornadoes or individual thunderstorms, but we can get information about the environments that are conducive to producing those kinds of storms. And we do see changes in some cases indicating that we likely will see an increase in the potential for severe weather. But the seasonality will also change. So they may not be occurring at the same times of year that they're occurring now. So we know, for instance, that if you're in the southern plains or central plains of the United States, that during May you're likely to see severe weather occur. But if you move to North Dakota or southern Canada, it might be in July. Mm-hmm. But the timing, the seasonality of those events may change. In the southeast here, for example, we see severe weather in November is actually a time of year that we see severe weather, not so much in December and January, but then again, starting in February, March, and into April, we may start to see more severe weather in January, for example.
And one quick thing, just so I, because I wasn't sure what 200 kilometers were, that'd be 124 miles, 125 miles. So go ahead.
Or you might see a snowfall in early October itself. I'm Jeff Turrentine from Monitor Magazine, an RDC publication. Blocking patterns are really interesting. You didn't mention it, but I think also the deluge in Colorado. And it occurs to me that duration is in itself a kind of extreme aspect of weather. You can have not terribly heavy rainfall, but if it lasts for 5 days, then it's effectively heavy rainfall. It can flood and cause all sorts of damage. As journalists, we're warned constantly not to make direct links between discrete weather events and climate change. Everybody wants to hear it from us. We always have to go back and say, no, you can't do it. Scientists are always saying, please don't attribute that to me, understandably. But it sounds like blocking patterns are kind of a link here, because from what I understand, you're saying that you can attribute the slowing of the jet stream to atmospheric warming causing mayhem at the poles, the North Pole, I guess, especially. And it, in turn, that is slowing down the jet stream, which means that we're going to have events of longer duration, whether it's a snowfall or a hurricane or a rainfall, that creates a discrete weather event that causes problems. That's a way of kind of drawing that line for people. So without saying this event was 100% caused by climate change, you can put those pieces together for them and let them come to a conclusion that you would support that conclusion, correct? Is that right?
Well, I wish Tom Carl had been able to be here, because I think he could talk directly about what we refer to as this attribution research. A couple of responses there. One is that I think that there's still some skepticism within the scientific community about the role of Arctic amplification in changing blocking patterns across the Northern Hemisphere. So that's not to suggest that won't bear out, in fact, to be correct, but there's still ongoing research, and we're still trying to tease out the effect of Arctic amplification on the jet stream. So it's still much work to be done there. In terms of does that provide a linkage to issues of attribution, I think potentially yes, it does. And I think that's partly why this area of research is so interesting right now, has generated so much public attention, has generated so much attention with the scientific community as well, too. Because it does allow a potential linkage. But there are other ways that we can look at issues of attribution as well. I don't know if anybody else wants to speak to the attribution issue.
One of the things we like to do to compare this is to kind of look at the steroid enhancement of baseball. And, you know, if you look at it at the baseball average of any one particular batter, say Mark McGwire or somebody, it would be really hard to attribute everything that's going on. He's a great player, and that's not going to change. Does the steroids add 10% to the length of his home runs? Does it decrease the number of injury days by a certain amount to allow him to get more at-bats? Things like that. So it's really hard to tease all that out. And the same thing is true with climate. But they have gone in and looked at some of these extreme events, for example, the Boulder floods or the Texas drought, and tried to tease out some of the things that might be enhancing one thing or another. I think I've seen studies from the Texas State climatologist that indicate that he thinks maybe 15% of the last Texas drought was directly something that he could attribute through whatever method he used to climate change. If you look at the floods in Boulder, the rainfall amounts there were very high. And one of the unusual things about that was how widespread that was. I used to work for the Weather Service on extreme weather. We really expected a big flood like that to be a really small-scale thing, like the big Thompson flood in 1976, where it was a very high, intense rainfall event, but not scattered over a wide area. And the fact that we were in this blocking pattern, we had a stream of water. Really, there was water coming in from the Gulf. There was water coming in from the Pacific at all different levels, all feeding into this one storm. Kind of set it up for a really perfect environment for building this storm over not just one individual canyon, but over a wide area. And so you could go in and say, well, how often does a humidity level of this event happen? If it happened 15% more, how would that change the dynamics of the storm? Now, you know, dynamics is a tricky business because you have to worry about not only the input of moisture, but you have to worry about how much is lifted, what the wind speeds are uphill, and all those things have to be taken into effect. And that's why attribution is hard, because it's never just a single thing that you can link in there, but you have to consider all these factors happening at once. And some of them act on opposite signs. So if you have one thing that's adding to the increase, another thing might be adding to a decrease. The same thing is true, for example, for development of hurricanes. You might have a change in the ocean temperatures, but you might also have changes in the upper level winds, and they act in opposite directions on the development of hurricanes. And so you have to consider that you can't maximize everything all at once, because that's not physically realistic. But what exactly do you do? That's not an easy question to answer.
But if one thinks of the jet stream as sort of a flow, a thing that keeps weather changing constantly over a geographical range, is it right to think that the slowing of the jet stream means that it's more likely that an event that takes place will last longer than it did, but for that decrease in flow? Does that make sense?
I think that's true. That's one of the areas that we haven't done as much research on. What's the average length of a blocking event? It's something that I think there are studies ongoing, but I don't think we have a lot of feel for even what has happened in the past, and we have to develop new data sets for that to get a feel for, you know, is this blocking event 3 days longer than on the average? That certainly, if that's true and there's trends in that, then that's something we need to look at. But it's not something that the data are necessarily easily available
for. That's something that really is part of this emerging body of research that I was talking about as well. So people are beginning to do those kinds of studies then.
Do you have anything to add?
Well, not really. I think, I just agree with what Steve said. Okay. Yeah. So.
Well, one thing that if Tom Carl had been here, he might have said, because he was on the conference call where they went over the study with reporters, NOAA and the British Meteorological Society, they're now doing an international review of the severe weather events of note each year. And on that last conference call, one of the climate scientists or researchers said, you know, we no longer have to say that we can't link a specific event to climate change. That's kind of old school thought, you know, was his basic point, and that this is like a synthesis of previous studies that this report that they release every year. And so I would just suggest you Google some stuff, or you can check with me and I'll find the link and get it for you. But so they are doing an annual review of major climate events that were studied by other researchers, and they're looking at, and then they present what that belief is. And we've had Seth Borenstein of SEJ wrote a news story on that latest study. So they looked at Hurricane Sandy and they looked at drought and they looked at some other things. One of the things that was pointed out in that study was that the Texas drought was linked, had a climate change footprint, but the Nebraska Central Plains drought this year, or that would have been 2011, the 2012 drought that hit Nebraska so hard did not. It was that extreme flash drought that just nailed the central part of the country, but there was not so much in the Central Plains of climate change footprint. So that's an example of how powerful just natural variation can be also. So, go ahead.
I just want to add one more example. So when there was a Russian heat wave in 2010, at the same time floods happened in Pakistan. That was like one of the very historical floods in that area. Now, people try to relate that with climate change, those floods, but those were like coupled phenomena. What happened over Russia actually partly triggered what happened over Pakistan, because there were like one high-pressure cell over Russia and one over China, and then there was a low-pressure cell that was sandwiched between these two high-pressure cells over northern Pakistan. Now, at the same time, there was La Nina and Pacific. Now, La Nina and Pacific actually drives more moisture toward that monsoon region in the summertime. So all these things coupled together to provide an environment that could just create rain and rain and rain for like 24 hours and more over that region. So if you look at the global picture, you can see these weather systems are coupled. So one kind of anomaly in one region can trigger another kind of anomaly in another region, but that does not necessarily mean that this is climate change. Because, I mean, these events have happened in the past, and they may keep on happening even without climate change. And also remember that climate change not only happens because of the humans, it also happens because of the natural variability.
Someone else?
On that same...
Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, Roger Archibald, freelance from Boston. On that same discussion about global impact, what's happening, I guess, over the oceans? Are we seeing changes in the prevailing westerlies that tend to blow in the temperate latitudes and the trade winds that you get in the tropics, and then those highs that we're familiar with, Atlantic high over Bermuda and the Pacific high in the Hawaii, between California and Hawaii. Are these showing significant variability as well?
I can talk about the tropics only. So with the tropics, there are two main circulations. One is a Walker circulation that goes from east-west, and one is Headley circulation in the north-south. Both are temperature-dependent. So there's a temperature gradient that drives those circulations. Last IPCC assessment report, even in this one, tells that these are going to, the Walker's aggression is going to get weaker because the temperature gradient is going to get weaker. So that's like a very robust kind of signal because of the climate change. And also, there are indications that Hadley circulation is going to expand. So if they're between 30 north and 30 south, now they're going to expand more toward the subtropics. But that actually is directly connected with the monsoon systems because monsoon systems remain within this belt. Now, that means that actually monsoon circulations are going to get weaker, but that does not necessarily mean that monsoon in different parts of the world actually is going to get weaker because there is another component that's moisture. So you're going to get more moisture in the atmosphere. So even with the weaker monsoon currents, if you have more moisture, you may end up getting more precipitation. So this is what is going to happen over the tropics, more or less. But again, as I noted earlier, that precipitation projections that are related with the circulation changes are not that very certain over the smaller regions in these IPCC projections because, again, of the scale are different at which these models run and the scale at which these processes actually run over these different regions across the globe.
We always want to, right, like this hurricane was caused by climate change or whatever, but how do we, and like I was in Texas during the drought and it was a big deal when the climatologist came out and said, you know, it was 15% was caused by climate change. But if the climate's always changing, then is it possible to go from this drought, climate change, and this portion of climate change is driven by human, or how do we, you know, that's the narrative line that the public picks up, but how do we navigate that accurately?
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Let me jump into this one, I guess. I think we have to keep in mind that drought is a natural part of variability. We're always going to have droughts and floods, and parts of the ecosystem depend on that as well. But how we handle those and how we're impacted by those really makes a difference. It's interesting, I think, to put those numbers to it, but I'm not sure it really gets us much of anything. Because we're going to have to deal with whatever the magnitude is, regardless of whether you can say 15% was caused by climate change or 20% or whatever. And so I think that's an interesting idea to look at, but I'm not sure in the long run that really helps us that much. And so I think we need to talk about people's increasing vulnerability to droughts, whatever the cause of them are. And so, you know, looking at that, to me, is really as important talking about people's increased sensitivity to droughts, increased sensitivity to water restrictions or temperature extremes or things like that. I think it's an interesting academic exercise to say that's 15%. I'm not sure in terms of its impact on people how much that really gets us. The answer is yes.
And so we're going to go on to this side of the room. And I apologize. I suppose I'm supposed to be repeating the question. Would you introduce yourself, please, and I'll repeat your question.
Tom Yulesman, Center for Environmental Journalism, and also blogger for Discover magazine. I want to get at this issue of flocking patterns and jet stream. But also just wanted to point out, I'm from Boulder, so I went through that event. And I also attended a conference or a seminar with Marty Hurling from NOAA and other attribution experts. They pointed out that 1938 or 1936, I can't remember which year, was an event that looked very similar to the one that happened a few weeks ago. So it sort of points out, you know, this issue that you were getting at, that we have to figure out a way to study to see how frequent that these blocking patterns have been in the past and whether it has changed. So my question is, I guess I'll ask a two-part question. Do we have any evidence that the jet stream is slowing down? And how do you actually study this thing? I mean, you know, so we can turn up these other weather events that have happened in the past, but how do you do this research to look at whether a changes have occurred in the blocking?
So the question is, do we have any evidence that the jet stream is slowing down, and how do we study that kind of phenomenon?
Well, I'll take the first crack at this. And essentially, the research that I mentioned by Francis and Vavaris, which came out in, what was it, 2011, was that right, or 2012, is fairly recently. That was primarily an observational study. And, in fact, some of the debate has been trying to link their observational findings to theory. And there's been some question about whether there is essentially a sufficient forcing by some of the changes that we see in the Arctic to be able to explain those changes that they observed in the mid-latitudes. But there have been other researchers, and I actually have some of them here, and I could certainly talk to you afterward and share with you some of those papers, have come to different conclusions. They've looked at some of the same data and come to different conclusions. And so that's why I say that it's still an area that's a relatively new area of research, definitely still needs additional work and really open to debate at this point. Observationally, but there are other papers that have looked at some of the same kinds of data and not come to the same conclusion, even with the observational data. And that's why there are things like this National Academies workshop that was going on to try to get some of the people who have done this work in the same room and really try to understand why they're seeing different things. So I think in terms of how we look at these kinds of patterns, in many cases, we're looking back at the same kinds of observational data that we're all working with, a lot of the same observational data, whether it's surface pressure data that's been collected from station observations, whether it's upper atmospheric observational data that's been collected either from, in some cases more recently, from satellite, but usually from radiosondes or balloon-launched instruments from around the globe. But that only stretches back really to the late 1940s. And into the 1950s. So we don't have a very long record that we can look at. You can look at other sources of information that might serve as proxies, but they're very indirect proxies, really, for this sort of phenomena. But, we work with what we have.
And one last point on that is the Jennifer Francis theory is being studied quite a bit because it's like a big aha. Yeah. It's like it's a missing link that kind of helps explain the mechanics that tie things together. So it is highly studied, but it is a big deal also.
Yeah, and it's again a topic that is of I know interest to the broader public, but also still very much an interest to the scientific community as well too.
Chuck Grumbach. Chuck Kornbach, on what's your take on adaption?
I'll start and then work our way down. I would say that we already know that we have a certain amount of climate change that's going to be baked into the system, no matter what happens today going forward. And so adaptation is going to be part of any reasonable response to climate change, period.
I will just talk in terms of where we are in terms of modeling the climate change impacts. We know, I think in terms of accuracy, we are very less accurate when we talk about climate change impacts. Again, because the climate change projections are available at the scale that are very irrelevant for the scales we talk about when we talk about adaptation. So to translate climate change projections to the scale that are relevant for policy making, there is not a developed framework. So what people do, take climate model output, put them, run them through an impact model, say crop model or hydrological model, and then provide some sort of XYZ projections. But there's a problem because these climate models, even at coarse resolution, they have kind of errors. And these errors may not matter at coarse scale, but when you go to very fine scale, these errors matter a lot, especially that kind of threshold response that we see in hydrology. And it. So, and then there are some kind of ad hoc protocols, like people do correction of these data sets before they use in hydrological models. So what I'll say that right now, we are not at a stage where we can say with great confidence that this is what is going to happen in our backyard because of the scale limitations. But at one of the work that we are doing at Oak Ridge National Lab is we are developing next generation of climate models. So IPCC models typically now run at like resolution, say, 150 kilometer. But we are developing next generation of climate models where we are going to run the next experiments at 25 kilometer resolution, even finer than that. Now, if you have that kind of climate modeling setup, that should enable us to tell the policymakers and the end user more accurately that what climate change means to them and how that's going to affect the cropping patterns or say the fine scale hydrology. But right now, I don't think we are at a stage where we can provide a concrete kind of assessments. So adaptation is still kind of fancy word for me, but I don't think we are there yet. Yeah.
And 25 kilometers is 15 miles.
And let me just, before we go on with that, let me just add that even though there's cost to adaptation, there's also economic benefits to it. And I think you have to really consider both. When you're adapting, you're being conserving of water, for example, you're saving resources in the costs of the chemicals that it takes to purify the water if you're talking about it for human consumption, the cost of running diesels to pump it. If you're conserving soil, then you're reducing the amount of fertilizer you might have to use in a future year. So there's definitely economic benefits to a lot of these adaptation measures that need to be factored in, too. There's definitely costs involved. And, you know, you can argue, and I'm not an economist or a politician, so you can argue about whether or not those are where you ought to spend your money. And I can't tell you that. But you can, I think it's really important to keep in mind that a lot of those are things that economically just make a lot of good sense. Conserving energy, conserving water, conserving soil, all those things are economic benefits that sort of balance out some of the economic costs that go in there. And so you really need to keep that in mind as well.
Harrison Dream's student at Greenlancer, if I remember correctly, the fourth assessment report had said, while there was a fair bit of uncertainty, that climate change, at least over the next 100 years, might actually provide a slight increase in yield for a lot of North American crops. Is that still kind of the consensus of agricultural researchers in this field, or is there just too much uncertainty?
So your name again? Harrison Drevis asked if going forward we're still going to see some benefit from climate change in the farm field. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. And one of the things about climate change is it doesn't impact every area at exactly the same rate or in exactly the same way. There's going to be winners and losers, especially when you're focused on just one particular aspect of that. I read a paper yesterday that said that they've seen greening of the globe as a whole by up to 15%. They attribute some of that to carbon dioxide fertilization. I think if you're looking especially at areas in the upper United States where you're going to have longer growing seasons, and as long as there's water available, which is the big if, they probably will see some increases in yields. And maybe that it's going to be more variable from one year to the next because it's going to really depend on water. Maybe other places they'll be able to do hybrids that are more adaptable to variable conditions or longer growing seasons or more heat that may have impacts as well or that may be impacted by these changes in climate. So I think there's going to be areas where they're going to see increases because of warming, at least temporarily. We don't know how long that's going to last because, of course, the climate doesn't just change once, but it's a continuum. And just because we get a short-term benefit doesn't mean that benefit's going to continue in the long term. And so that's really hard to answer.
And one place you can go to get some local information is the National Climate Assessment, which was just finished. and they do region by region of the country, and they look sector by sector. So they look at ag, and they look at water, and they look at health. And in the one for my area, they talked about, well, when will we start seeing a decline? Because production in Iowa and Nebraska has benefited from climate change. And it talks a little bit about when that might start lessening and then go the other direction. So look for your regional assessment.
Thank you.
Another question? Yeah.
I'm curious about, for the expert in the Southwest, there's a researcher at Scripps named Sasha Gershkov who's identified a new kind of heat wave, he thinks, that hits California with high humidity, hot nights, very deadly. There was a big heat wave in 2006, and I wonder if that showed up in your model.
Your name, please.
So your question in the heat wave that happened in 2006, whether that showed up in the model. Well, I don't want to go into the detail of the models. Normally when you run in climate simulations, before you run them, if you run them, say, with observed conditions, say you provide observed sea surface temperatures to your climate model, it should be able to replicate some of the events that you talked about. But when we do the climate change experiments, we don't use any of those observed conditions. All we use in the baseline historical period is the observed greenhouse gas forcing, and for the future, we use the projected forcings. Now, in that kind of experimental setup, you would not replicate any individual event. But what we can replicate, say, if there's an upward or downward trend, the model should be able to tell that. Should be able to capture that, but any individual event, it would not be possible in that kind of situation. Yeah.
Alan Bess from Colorado. Do the climate models show a clear tipping point, if you will, when anthropogenic greenhouse gases start becoming, bringing out the changed climate to emerge from the noise of normal variability?
Well, I think I mentioned that a bit earlier. When you talk about the heat waves, say, for example, just take the heat waves. So your question is that when a new climate system would emerge that is beyond the natural variability that we seek, it totally depends and region-specific. Again, if you have very low variability in the baseline period, you expect to see a new emergence of a new climate state much earlier in your future projections. For example, over the Southwest, because you have very low variability. But in contrast, over the Southeast, where you have very high variability, you don't see that happening even until the end of 21st century. So it totally depends on the region characteristics. So yes, the regions where you have very low variability, like Southwest, there is a robust climate change response that most of hot extremes are going to appear much earlier, which means in next 2-3 decades over the Southwest. But over other regions where you have very high variability, it will take much longer time in our simulations to get out of that signal-to-noise ratio. Yeah.
And we have time for probably one last question, so go ahead.
Yeah, in terms of agriculture,
The question is, what are the biggest concerns for agriculture in the future? I mean, the number one issue, I think, for agriculture is probably water availability overall. And water, unfortunately, is the area that the climate models in general are the weakest, because a lot of it happens on really small subgrid scale kind of storms, thunderstorms or something like that. So it's really hard to do that. That's why it's important to figure out ways to be resilient, ways to get water, either by having a farm pond, if you're in a small farm and you have the space for one and you're able to pump it. Obviously, that wouldn't work so well in the Southwest because it would probably all evaporate anyway. So I think water availability is probably the number one issue. Dealing with water wisely, being able to use it. We know in the Southeast, we get, in our worst years, we're still getting 35 inches of rain a year. And so if you have the ability to add even 4 inches at a critical time, you're going to probably bring in a crop. Now, that's not going to be so possible if you're in the Western High Plains, where you're only getting 10 or 15 inches of rain a year. So water is probably the number one aspect. I think in terms of dealing with temperature change, farmers have flexibility to vary their crops, and most of them are doing that already. And so they can pick varieties that will take advantage of what you might expect from the climate in terms of the length of the growing season or the number of growing degree days or things like that. Or you can switch from one variety, say, of corn to another variety of corn. We know that farmers are already adapting to that. We know that there's corn growing in places now in the upper Midwest that it never was before because they're having more access to rain. The temperatures are changing there. The water's changing there. And also wheat. So we know farmers are already adapting to that. In the Southeast, a lot of farmers now are going to two crop seasons where they grow something early in the season, they harvest it, they put in a second crop. If you've got a longer growing season, that is a possibility. So that's a way of farm management that you can go in and do that. You have the capability of switching to a different kind of crop. Obviously, you know, you've got to worry about things like, is this crop insurable? Some crops are insurable. A lot of the crops in the Southeast are not. Corn and soybeans, yeah, but other things that are more specialized, not so much. And so, you know, a farmer is always trying to weigh all those things, the cost of how much fertilizer they're going to have to put in or how many other pesticides or other chemicals they're going to have to put in, how much diesel they're going to have to run, because every time they run a tractor through a field, they're using diesel fuel. And so all those things have to be taken into effect. But I think for agriculture, water availability is really the key.
Any final thoughts from anyone else? Thank you. Nope. Okay. This has been a great session. Thank you very much. Thank you, Tom.